and on, continuing even as Lincoln tries to speak. The crowd cannot possibly know the tremendous weight pressing down on Abraham Lincoln's shoulders. Looking out into the audience, he prepares to tell them about the daunting task ahead and how the ability to trust the southern states to peacefully rejoin the Union will be as great a challenge to the nation as the war itself. Lincoln clearly sees the faces of the crowd with their spontaneous smiles and unabashed joy and prepares to deliver a speech that is anything but warm-hearted. It is, in fact, a heavy, ponderous, de facto State of the Union address, specifically designed to undercut the revelry and prepare America for years of more pain and struggle. The president begins gently. "We meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart," Lincoln says. He thanks General Grant and the Army for their struggle and promises to have a National Day of Celebration very soon, with a great parade through Washington. Lincoln is one of the best speakers in America, if not the world. He can read the mood of a crowd and adjust the cadence and rhythm of his voice for maximum effect, coaxing whatever emotion or response is needed to hold the audience in the palm of his hand. Lincoln's voice is clear, his pronunciation distinct. He understands the power of words and emphasizes certain phrases to make a lasting impression. The Gettysburg Address is perhaps the best example of Lincoln's oratorical genius. But tonight, there is no theatricality, no tricks, just cold, hard facts delivered in a somber and even depressing monotone. The speech is so long and so unexciting that people in the audience begin shifting their feet and then lowering their heads and slipping away into the night, off to search for a real celebration. Booth stays, of course. He doesn't want to miss a single word. He listens as Lincoln talks of extending suffrage to literate blacks and those who fought for the Union. Booth seethes at the outrageous notion that slaves be considered equal citizens of the United States, able to own property, vote, run for elected office, and maybe even marry white women. Suffrage, as preposterous as it sounds, means a black man might someday become president of the United States. Booth cannot let this ever happen. That means nigger citizenship, he hisses, pointing to the Navy revolver on Powell's hip. 14 inches long, with a pistol sight and a 36 caliber round, the Colt has more than enough pop to kill Lincoln from such close range. "Shoot him now," Booth commands Powell. "Put a bullet in his head right this instant." Powell is a dangerous young man, with powerful shoulders and a psychotic temper, but he refuses to draw his weapon. He's terrified of offending Booth, but even more afraid of the mob, which would surely tear him limb from limb. Booth sizes up the situation. It would be easy enough to grab Powell's gun and squeeze off a shot or two before the crowd overpowers him. But now is not the time to be impulsive. Booth certainly doesn't tell us to Powell. Instead, he lets Powell believe that he has let Booth down. Only when Powell believes that he has really and truly disappointed Booth will he begin thinking of ways to make it up to him. And that's when Booth will tell him about this amazing new plan. "I'll put him through," Booth sneers, planting another seed about the assassination in the minds of Powell and Harold. "By God, I'll put him through." Then Booth spins around and fights his way back out of the crowd. 24 hours ago, he was still thinking of ways to kidnap the president. Now, he knows just where and how, and when, he will shoot Abraham Lincoln dead. The date will be Thursday, April 13th. Or, as it was known back in Julius Caesar's time, the Ides. Chapter 21, Tuesday, April 11th, 1865, Washington, D.C., nighttime. "It seems strange how much there is in the Bible about dreams," Lincoln says thoughtfully, basking in the afterglow of his speech. It is just after 10 p.m. The people of Washington have moved their party elsewhere, and the White House lawn is nearly empty. Lincoln is having tea and cake in the Red Room with Mary, Senator James Harlan, and a few friends. Among them is Ward Hill Lamon, the close friend with the beer barrel girth. Lamon, the United States Marshal for the District of Columbia, has warned Lincoln for more than a year that someone somewhere will try to kill him. The lawman listens to the president intently with a veteran policeman's heightened sense of foreboding, sifting and sorting through each word. Lincoln continues, "There are, I think, some 16 chapters in the Old Testament and 4 or 5 in the New in which dreams are mentioned. If we believe the Bible, we must accept the fact that in the old days, God and his angels came to men in their sleep and made themselves known in dreams. Mary Lincoln smiles nervously at her husband. His melancholy tone has her fearing the worst. Why do you believe in dreams? Yes, Lincoln believes in dreams and in nightmares, and in their power to haunt a man. Night is a time of terror for Abraham Lincoln. The bodyguards standing watch outside his bedroom hear him moan in his sleep as his worries and anxieties are unleashed by the darkness, when the distractions and the busyness of the day can no longer keep them at bay. Very often he cannot sleep at all. Lincoln collapsed from exhaustion just 1 month ago. He is pale, 35 pounds underweight, and walks with a hunched, painful gait of a man whose shoes are filled with pebbles. One look at the bags under his eyes, and even hardened newspapermen write that he needs to conserve his energies, not just to heal the nation, but to live out his second term. At 56 years old, Abraham Lincoln is spent. Of course, there have been threats against Lincoln's life ever since he was first elected. Gift baskets laden with fruit were sent to the White House, mostly from addresses in the South. The apples and pears and peaches were very fresh and very deadly, their insides injected with poison. Lincoln had the good sense to have them all tested before taking a chance and chomping down into a first fatal bite. Then there was the Baltimore plot in 1861, in which a group known as the Knights of the Golden Circle planned to shoot Lincoln as he traveled to Washington for the inauguration. The plot was foiled thanks to brilliant detective work by Pinkerton agents. In a strange twist, many newspapers mocked Lincoln for the way he eluded the assassins by wearing a cheap disguise as he snuck into Washington. His enemies made much of the deception, labeling Lincoln a coward and refusing to believe that such a plot existed in the first place. The president took the cheap shots to heart. The Baltimore plot taught Lincoln a powerful message about public perception. He adopted a veneer of unshakable courage from that day forward. Now he would never dream of traveling in disguise. He moves freely throughout Washington. Since 1862, he has enjoyed military protection beyond the walls of the White House. But it was only late in 1864, as the war wound down and the threats became more real, that Washington's Metropolitan Police assigned a select group of officers armed with .38 caliber pistols to protect Lincoln on a more personal basis. Two remain at his side from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Another stays with Lincoln until midnight, when a fourth man takes the graveyard shift, posting himself outside Lincoln's bedroom or following the president through the White House on his insomniac nights. The bodyguards are paid by the Department of the Interior, and their job description, strangely enough, specifically states that they are to protect the White House from vandals. Protecting Lincoln is second on their list of priorities. If he were the sort of man to worry about his personal safety, Lincoln wouldn't allow such easy public access to the White House. There's no fence or gate blocking people from entering the White House at this time. The doorman is instructed to allow citizens to roam the first floor. Friends and strangers alike can congregate inside the building all day long, seeking political favors, stealing scraps of curtains as keepsakes, or just peering in at the president while he works. Some petitioners even sleep on the floor in the hallways, hoping to gain a moment of Lincoln's time. Lincoln's bright young secretary, John Hay, frets constantly about his boss's safety. The president is so accessible that any villain can feign business, and while talking with him, draw a razor and cut his throat, Hay worries aloud. And some minutes might elapse after the murderer's escape before we could even discover what had been done. Lincoln, however, reminds Hay that being president of the United States stipulates that he be a man of the people. It would never do for a president to have guards with drawn sabers at his door, as if he were, or were assuming to be, an emperor, he reminds them. Death is no stranger to Abraham Lincoln, and in that way, it is less terrifying. The Lincoln's 3-year-old son, Edward, died of tuberculosis in 1850. In 1862, the Lincolns lost 11-year-old Willie to a fever. Willie was a spirited child, fond of wrestling with his father and riding his pony on the White House lawn. Mary, who already suffered from a mental disorder that made her prone to severe mood swings, was emotionally devastated by the loss of her boys. Even as Lincoln was mired in the war and dealing with his own grief, he devoted hours to tending to Mary and the silent downward spiral that seemed to define her daily existence. He indulged her by allowing her to spend lavishly, to the point of putting him deeply in debt, though he is by nature a very simple and frugal man. Also, to please Mary, he accompanied her to a night at the theater or to a party, when he would much rather conserve his energies by relaxing with a book at the White House. And while this indulgence has worked to some extent, and Mary Lincoln has gotten stronger over time, Lincoln, of all people, knows that she is one great tragedy away from losing her mind. Normally, their history precludes Lincoln from talking about death with Mary present. But now, surrounded by friends and empowered by the confessional tone of that night's speech, he cannot help himself. "I had a dream the other night, which has haunted me ever since," he admits soulfully. "You frighten me," Mary cries. Lincoln will not be stopped. 10 days ago, he begins, "I went to bed late." 10 days ago, he was in City Point. Each man and woman in the room calculated that. It was the night Lincoln stood alone on the top deck of the River Queen, watching Grant's big guns blow the Confederate defenders of Petersburg to hell. "I had been waiting for an important dispatch from the front. I could not have been long in bed when I fell into a slumber, for I was weary. I soon began to dream." In addition to being the consummate public speaker, Lincoln is also a master storyteller. No matter how heavy the weight of the world, he invests himself in a story, adjusting the tone and cadence of his voice and curling his lips into a smile as he weaves his tale, until the listener eventually leans in, desperate to hear more. But now there is pain in Lincoln's voice, and not a hint of a smile. The president is not telling a story, but reliving an agony. "There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me. Then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs. There the silence was broken by the same pitiful sobbing, but the mourners were invisible. I went from room to room. No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. It was light in all of the rooms. Every object was familiar to me. But where were all the people who were grieving as if their hearts would break? I was puzzled and alarmed. What could be the meaning of all this?" Lincoln is lost in the world of that dream, yet his audience, uncomfortable as it may feel, is breathless with anticipation. Determined to find the cause of a state of things so mysterious and shocking, "I kept on until I arrived in the East Room, which I entered. There I was met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse, wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers, who were acting as guards. And there were a throng of people, some gazing mournfully upon the corpse, whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. 'Who is dead in the White House?' I demanded one of the soldiers. 'The president,' was the answer. 'He was killed by an assassin.' Then came a loud burst of grief from the crowd. Mary cannot take it anymore. 'That is horrid,' she wails. 'I wish you had not told it.'" Lincoln is pulled back to reality, no longer sound asleep on the River Queen, but sitting with a somewhat shell-shot gathering of dignitaries in the here and now. Young Clara Harris, in particular, looks traumatized. "Well, it was only a dream, Mary," he chides. "Let us say no more about it." A moment later, seeing the uneasiness in the room, Lincoln adds, "Don't you see how it will all turn out? In this dream, it was not me, but some other fellow that was killed." His words convince no one, especially not Mary. Chapter 22, Wednesday, April 12th, 1865, Washington, morning. After a light breakfast and a night of restless sleep, John Wilkes Booth walks the streets of Washington, his mind filled with the desperate strands of an unfinished plan. The more he walks, the more it all comes together. It is the morning after Lincoln's speech and the third day since Lee's surrender. Booth frames every action through the prism of the dramatic, a trait that comes from being born and raised in an acting household. As he builds the assassination scheme in his head, layer by layer, everything from the location to its grandiosity is designed to make him the star performer in an epic, scripted tale. His will be the biggest assassination plot ever, and his commanding performance will guarantee him an eternity of recognition. He knows there will be an audience. by the morning after Lincoln's speech, Booth has decided to shoot the president inside a theater, the one place in the world where Booth feels most comfortable. Lincoln is known to attend the theater frequently. In fact, he has seen Booth perform, although Lincoln's presence in the House so angered Booth that he delivered a notably poor performance. So the theater it will be. Booth has performed at several playhouses in Washington. He knows their hallways and passages by heart. A less informed man might worry about being trapped inside a building with a limited number of exits, no windows, and a crowd of witnesses, many of them able-bodied men just back from the war, but not John Wilkes Booth. His solitary walk takes him past many such soldiers. The Army hasn't been disbanded yet, so they remain in uniform. Even someone as athletic as Booth looks far less rugged than these men who have spent so much of their time in the open air, their bodies lean and hard from hours on the march. If he thought about it, their acquaintance with weapons and hand-to-hand combat would terrify Booth, with his choreographed stage fights and pea-shooter pistol. But Booth is not scared of these men. In fact, he wants to linger for a moment at center stage, with the stage light shining down on his handsome features, clutching a dagger with America, land of the free, inscribed on the blade. He plans to spend what will surely be the last seconds of his acting career making a political statement. Sic semper tyrannis, he will bellow in his most vibrant thespian delivery, thus always to tyrants. The dagger is useless as a stage prop. Booth has no specific plans to use it, knowing that if he fires a shot from a few feet away and it misses, there will be no chance to run at Lincoln and stab him. He has borrowed the idea from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, which he performed 6 months earlier on Broadway, with his two actor brothers, both of whom he despises. Booth, ironically, played Mark Antony, a character whose life is spared from a potential assassin. Those performances provided Booth with his inspiration about the Ides. In Roman times, it was a day of reckoning. The Ides are tomorrow. Booth walks faster, energized by the awareness that he hasn't much time. He must find out whether Lincoln will be attending the theater tomorrow night, and if so, which one. He must find out which play is being performed, so that he can select just the right moment in the show for the execution, a moment with few actors on stage, if possible, so that when he stops to utter his immortal line, there won't be a crowd to tackle him. The details of his escape are still fuzzy, but the basic plan is to gallop out of Washington on horseback and disappear into the loving arms of the South, where friends and allies and even complete strangers who have heard of his daring deed will see to it that he makes it safely to Mexico. But that's not all. There are rumors that General Grant will be in town. If he attends the theater with Lincoln, which is a very real possibility, Booth can kill the two most prominent architects of the South's demise within seconds. And yet Booth wants even more. He has been an agent of the Confederacy for a little less than a year and has had long conversations with the leaders of the Confederate Secret Service and men like John Surratt, discussing what must be done to topple the Union. He has at his disposal a small cadre of like-minded men prepared to do his bidding. He personally witnessed the Northern crowd's malice toward the South at Lincoln's speech last night. Rather than just kill Lincoln and Grant, he now wants to do nothing less than undertake a top-down destruction of the entire government of the United States of America. Vice President Andrew Johnson is an obvious target. He is first in line to the presidency, lives at a nearby hotel, and is completely unguarded. Like all Confederate sympathizers, Booth views the Tennessee politician as a turncoat for siding with Lincoln. Secretary of State William H. Seward, whose oppressive policies toward the South have long made him a target of Confederate wrath, is on the list as well. The deaths of Lincoln, Grant, Johnson, and Seward should be more than enough to cause anarchy. To Lewis Powell, a former Confederate spy who watched Lincoln's speech with Booth, will go the task of killing Secretary Seward, who, at age 63, is currently bedridden after a near-fatal carriage accident. He was traveling through Washington with his son Frederick and daughter Fanny when the horses bolted. While reaching for the reins to try to stop them, Seward caught the heel of one of his new shoes on the carriage step and was hurled from the cab, hitting the street so hard that bystanders thought he'd been killed. Secretary Seward has been confined to his bed for a week with severe injuries and is on an around-the-clock course of pain medication. Seward has trouble speaking. He has no chance of leaping from the bed to elude a surprise attack. Powell's job should be as simple as sneaking into the Seward home, shooting the sleeping secretary in bed, and then galloping away to join Booth for a life of sunshine and easy living in Mexico. For the job of killing Johnson, Booth selects a simpleton drifter named George Azaro, a German carriage repairer with a sallow complexion and a fondness for drink. To him will go the job of assassinating the vice president at the exact same time Booth is killing Lincoln. Azaro, however, still thinks the plan is to kidnap Lincoln. He was brought into the plot for his encyclopedic knowledge of the smuggling routes from Washington into the Deep South. Booth suspects that Azaro may be unwilling to go along with the new plan. Should that be the case, Booth has a foolproof plan in mind to blackmail Azaro into going along. Booth has seen co-conspirators come and go since last August. Right now he has three: Powell, Azaro, and David Herold, the Georgetown graduate who also accompanied Booth on the night of Lincoln's speech. One would imagine that each man would be assigned to a murder victim. Logically, Herold's job would be to kill Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, the man who trampled the Constitution by helping Lincoln suspend the writ of habeas corpus and did more than any other to treat the South like a bastard child. Stanton is the second most powerful man in Washington, but in the end, no assassin is trained on him. Instead, Herold will act as the dim-witted Powell's guide, leading his escape out of Washington in the dead of night. Why was the Secretary of War spared? The answer may come from a shadowy figure named Lafayette Baker. Early in the war, Baker distinguished himself as a Union spy. Secretary of State William Seward hired him to investigate Confederate communications that were being routed through Maryland. Baker's success in this role saw him promoted to the War Department, where Secretary of War Edwin Stanton gave him full power to create an organization known as the National Detective Police. This precursor to the Secret Service was a counterterrorism unit tasked with seeking out Confederate spy networks in Canada, New York, and Washington. But Lafayette Baker was a shifty character with loyalties undefined except for his love of money and of himself, though not necessarily in that order. Secretary Stanton grew weary of him, so Baker returned to New York City. His movements during this time are murky, as befitting a man who thinks himself a spy. But one elaborate theory ties together his activities with those of John Wilkes Booth. This theory suggests that Lafayette Baker worked as an agent for a Canadian outfit known as the J.J. Chaffee Company. Baker received payments totaling almost $150,000 from that firm, an unheard-of sum at that time. The J.J. Chaffee Company also paid John Wilkes Booth nearly $15,000 between August 24th and October 5th, 1864. He was paid in gold, credited to the Bank of Montreal. In the same month the last payment was made to him, Booth traveled to Montreal to collect the money and rendezvous with John Surratt and other members of the Confederate Secret Service to plot the Lincoln issue. The common thread in the several mysterious payments and missives involving Baker and Booth is the mailing address, 178.5 Water Street. This location, quite mysteriously, is referenced in several documents surrounding payments between the J.J. Chaffee Company, Baker, and Booth. To this day, no one has discovered why the J.J. Chaffee Company paid Lafayette Baker and John Wilkes Booth for anything. A few clues exist, including a telegram sent on April 2, 1865, the very same day on which Lincoln stood atop the deck of the River Queen to watch the fall of Petersburg. A telegram was sent from 178.5 Water Street to a company in Chicago. Quote, J.W. Booth will ship oysters until Saturday the 15th, it reads, intimating that Booth, a man who never worked a day in his life in the shipping or the oyster business, was involved in some kind of project that was totally inappropriate for his skills. And yet no one has been able to conclusively determine what the telegram alluded to. Lafayette Baker freely admitted that he had tapped Secretary of War Stanton's telegraph lines, though he never explained why he did what he did. Baker would have known that if Lincoln were assassinated, ascension to the presidency could eventually fall to Stanton, the man who ran against Lincoln in 1860. The United States has had a succession plan in place since 1792, with the vice president replacing the fallen president, as when Zachary Taylor died in office and was succeeded by Millard Fillmore. If a more elaborate assassination plot were hatched, one that killed Vice President Andrew Johnson and Secretary of State William Seward, along with President Lincoln, a skilled constitutional scholar like Edwin Stanton could attempt to manipulate the process in his favor, and perhaps even become president. This connection between Baker, Booth, and Stanton continues to intrigue and befuddle scholars. Why was Lafayette Baker, a spy, paid an exorbitant amount of money for his services? And why did John Wilkes Booth secure a healthy payment from the same company? Clues such as this point to Stanton's involvement, but no concrete connection has ever been proven. Circumstantially, he was involved. Secretary Stanton employed Baker, who was in regular contact with Surratt and Booth. Some historians believe that Stanton fired Baker as a cover and that the two remained in close contact. Or so the elaborate theory goes. Whether or not that is true, Stanton will be the sole reason that Lafayette Baker's role in the dramatic events of April 1865 is hardly over. Booth is satisfied that his plan is simple enough that the synchronized slayings will not tax the mental capacities of his underlings. Now all he needs to do is find Abraham Lincoln. The odds of Lincoln's remaining at the White House on such an auspicious night of celebration are almost non-existent. The president and Mrs. Lincoln are known to be fond of the theater and prone to making their public appearances in such a venue. They will either be there or at one of the many parties being held to celebrate the city's grand illumination. If it is to be an illumination party, Booth will canvass the city's notable residences for signs of a celebration. Once the president is located, the next step will be waiting for a moment when he is unguarded, whereupon Booth can use his celebrity to gain entrance and then shoot him. If it is to be the theater, the obvious choices are either the Grover or Ford's, both of which are staging lavish productions. Booth must reacquaint himself with their floor plans so that when the moment comes, he can act without thinking. Booth turns the corner onto Pennsylvania Avenue. First stop, Grover's Theater. The assassination will be tomorrow. Chapter 23. Wednesday, April 12, 1865, Washington, afternoon. Inside the White House, just a few blocks from where John Wilkes Booth is walking the streets, a beaming Mary Lincoln holds a slim leather-bound copy of Julius Caesar. She's in a good mood for a change, and the new book is certainly helping her disposition. The president will be thrilled by her purchase. This is most important to Mary Lincoln. Even in her lowest moods, she craves the attention and affection of her husband. Lincoln's fondness for all things Shakespeare is well known. While he enjoys lowbrow entertainment like comedian Barney Williams, who performs in blackface, he never misses the chance to attend a Shakespearean tragedy. During one two-month span in the winter of 1864, he saw Richard III, The Merchant of Venice, Hamlet, and, of course, Julius Caesar. The actor playing all the lead roles was Edwin Booth, John's older brother. In addition to his acting, he did the Lincolns an inadvertent favor by saving the life of their eldest son. When 20-year-old Union officer Robert Todd Lincoln was shoved from a crowded railway platform into the path of an ongoing train, it was Edwin Booth who snatched him by the coat collar and pulled him back up to safety. Robert never mentioned the incident to his father, but his commanding officer, Ulysses S. Grant, personally wrote a letter of thanks to the actor. Edwin's brother's reaction to this incident has never been determined, if he knew at all. This is the second remarkable coincidence linking Robert Todd Lincoln to John Wilkes Booth, the first being his infatuation with Lucy Hale, Booth's fiancée. Robert is due back in Washington any day, as is Grant. Lincoln's spirits will soar at the sight of both men. But in the meantime, Mary cannot wait to see his face light up when she presents him with Julius Caesar. Lincoln is fond of two books more than any other, the Bible and Shakespeare's collected works. Like his dog-eared Bible, Lincoln's volume of Shakespeare has become frayed and worn over the years. This brand new copy of Julius Caesar will certainly keep the president's mood upbeat, which in turn will do wonders for Mary's morale. Their euphorias and depressions are so closely intertwined that it's hard to say which one's emotional peaks and valleys influence the other more. Lincoln is not at the White House right now. He's taking a walk over to the War Department, where he sits on a comfortable sofa, hard at work on the business of healing the nation. His first test is immediate. The Virginia legislature is about to convene in Richmond. These are the same elected representatives who once voted to leave the Union. Now this rebel legislature will meet in the giant column building designed by Thomas Jefferson, determined to rebuild the shattered state and return it to its former glory. On the surface, that's a good thing. Lincoln himself urged the legislature to convene during a visit to Richmond the previous week, saying that, quote, the prominent and influential men of their respective counties should come together and undo their own work, unquote. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, the brilliant Ohio lawyer who is, for whatever reason, not on Booth's list of targets, and in whose office Lincoln now sits, is strongly opposed. He tells Lincoln that to place such powers in the Virginia legislature would be giving away the scepter of the conqueror, that it would transfer the result of the victory of our arms to the very legislature which 4 years before said, give us war. Lincoln disagrees. He's reluctant to see the United States Army turned into an occupying force, policing the actions of legislatures throughout the South. But he also realizes that by allowing Virginia's lawmakers to meet without close federal observation, he is setting a dangerous precedent. There would be nothing to stop other southern states from passing laws that conspire against the federal government, in effect, keeping the Confederacy's ideals alive. Stanton and Lincoln were once sworn rivals, two opinionated and charismatic Midwesterners who came to Washington with their own personal visions of what the country needed. They are physical opposites, Stanton's stump to Lincoln's beanpole. Stanton didn't vote for Lincoln in 1860, but that didn't stop the president from crossing party lines to name him Attorney General, then Secretary of War. Lincoln's low wartime popularity was matched only by that of Stanton, who was relentless in his prosecution of any Union officer concealing Confederate sympathies. He is the rock on the beach of our national ocean against which the breakers dash and roar without ceasing, Lincoln once said of Stanton. I do not see how he survives, why he is not crushed and torn to pieces. Without him, I should be destroyed. As General Sam Grant glibly describes Stanton, he was an able constitutional lawyer and jurist, but the Constitution was not an impediment to him while the war lasted. Stanton, with a graying beard extending halfway down his chest, has a sort of strong-willed personality that terrifies timid souls. The Civil War may be over, but Lincoln has made it clear that the Secretary of War will be instrumental in helping the country rebuild. He trusts Stanton's counsel and uses him as a sounding board when tough decisions like this one must be made. In many ways, Stanton does not behave as if he is a subordinate to Lincoln. He expresses himself without fear of edit or censure, knowing that while Lincoln has strong opinions of his own, he's a good listener who can be swayed by a solid argument. Now Stanton paces before the couch where Lincoln reclines, compiling his detailed argument against allowing the Virginia legislature to meet. He warns of the laws that might be passed, limiting the freedom of former slaves. He notes that the legislature has proven itself to be untrustworthy. And he reminds Lincoln that during his recent visit to Richmond, the president made it clear that the Virginia lawmakers were being given only conditional authority, but that these same untrustworthy men are surely capable of ignoring those limits once they convene. At last, Stanton explains his idea for temporary military governments in the southern states until order can be restored. Lincoln doesn't speak until Stanton finishes. Almost every single one of Stanton's opinions runs contrary to Lincoln's. Nonetheless, Lincoln hears Stanton out and then lets his own thoughts percolate. As Stanton looks on, Lincoln slowly rises off the couch and draws himself up to his full towering height. He walks to the great oak desk near the window, where he silently composes a telegram withdrawing permission for the Virginia legislature to meet. For those representatives who have already traveled to Richmond for the session, he guarantees safe passage home. Lincoln hands a telegram to Stanton, whose thick beard cannot hide his look of satisfaction after he finishes reading. Calling the wording exactly right, he hands the telegram to his clerk. During the course of the Civil War, Lincoln's use of telegrams, his T-mail, made him the first leader in world history to communicate immediately with his generals on the battlefield. He has sent literally thousands of these messages through the Department of War. This is his last. On the walk back to the White House, Lincoln composes another sort of note in his head. It's to Mary, a simple invitation to go for a carriage ride on Friday afternoon. His words are playful and romantic, a reminder of the way things were before the war and before the death of Willie. Their eldest son, Robert, is due home from the war any day. Surely the cloud of melancholy that has hovered over the Lincolns is about to lift. Chapter 24, Thursday, April 13th, 1865. Washington, morning. The Ides. As John Wilkes Booth takes the train to Baltimore, hoping to reenlist a former conspirator for that night's expected executions, General Ulysses S. Grant and his wife, Julia, arrive in Washington at dawn. They have taken an overnight boat from City Point, Virginia. Grant is in no mood to be there. He is eager to push on to New Jersey to see their four children, but Secretary of War Stanton has specifically requested that the general visit the Capitol and handle a number of war-related issues. Grant's plan is to get in and get out within 24 hours, with as little fuss as possible. With him are his aide, Colonel Horace Porter, and two sergeants to manage the Grant's luggage. Little does Grant know that an adoring Washington crowd is waiting to wrap its arms around him. As we reached our destination that bright morning in our boat, Julia later exclaimed, every gun in and near Washington burst forth, and such a salvo. All the bells rang out merry greetings, and the city was literally swathed in flags and bunting. If anything, Grant is even more beloved than the president right now. Strangers cheer the Grant's open-air carriage on its way to the Willard Hotel on the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and 14th Street. As they pull up to the entrance, workers are on the roof installing the gas jets that will spell out Union for that evening's grand illumination, a mass lighting of every candle, gas lamp, and firework in the city. Thousands upon thousands of people are now streaming into Washington to witness what will be an attempt to turn night into day, as yet another celebration of the war's end. Grant, who has seen more than his share of fiery explosions, could not care less about the illumination. Their journey has been an odyssey, and the Grants are exhausted. Since leaving Lee at Appomattox, U.S. Grant has endured 2 days of train derailments, another day waiting for a steamer in City Point, and then the dawn-to-dusk journey up the Potomac. But standing beside his beloved Julia revives Grant. They have been a couple for more than 20 years and have endured many a long separation thanks to the military life. It was Julia's letters that sustained him during the Mexican War when he was a homesick young lieutenant. And it was Julia who stood by her husband's side during the 1850s when he was discharged from the Army and failed in a succession of businesses. They are happiest in each other's company. Both are still young. He is not quite 43. She is 39. They have their whole lives in front of them. The sooner they can flee Washington and get back to normal life, the better. And right now that means getting to their room, washing up, and letting the general race over to the War Department as quickly as possible. There's just one problem. The Grants don't have a reservation at the Willard. U.S. Grant has slept so many nights in impromptu battlefield lodgings procured on the fly by his staff that it never crossed his mind to send a telegram asking for a room. What he wants, he tells the flustered desk clerk, is a simple bedroom with an adjacent sitting room. It's understood that Colonel Porter will need a room, too. The sergeants will bunk elsewhere. The Willard Hotel is overbooked, yet to allow the famous U.S. Grant to take a room elsewhere would be an unthinkable loss of prestige. Some way, somehow, rooms are instantly made available. Within minutes, Julia is unpacking their suitcases. Word about their location is already flying around Washington, and bundles of congratulatory telegrams and flowers soon flood the desk and bedroom. Julia will spend the afternoon reading each one, basking in the awareness that the man whose potential she had seen so long before, when he was just a quiet young lieutenant, has ascended from anonymity and disgrace to the level of great historical figure. Not that General Grant cares. He just wants to get on with his business and get home. Within minutes, he and Porter meet in the lobby before the short walk to the War Department. It's three blocks, just on the other side of the White House. The two men step out onto Pennsylvania Avenue. At first, the trek is easy, just two regular guys in uniform joining the sea of pedestrians, soldiers, and all those tourists pouring into the city for the illumination. But Grant is hard to miss. Photographs of his bearded, expressionless face have been on the front pages of newspapers for more than a year. Soon the autograph seekers and well-wishers, startled but elated by his presence, surround him. Porter tries to push them back, protecting his general in peacetime as he did in warfare. But he is just one man against the many, and the diminutive Grant is swallowed by the mob. Porter pushes and elbows, grabbing Grant with one arm while shoving people back with the other. It's a benevolent crowd, cheering for Grant even though they strain to touch him. But Porter knows a simple truth. This is the perfect opportunity for a disgruntled Southerner to take a shot at Grant, then disappear in an instant. Just when the situation begins to border on pandemonium, the Metropolitan Police come to their rescue. Grant and Porter are soon on their way again, this time inside a carriage with a cavalry escort. An introvert, Grant is pained by the attention and stares. Once inside the War Department, he hurries to formally conclude the logistics of war. Pen in hand and cigar clenched in his teeth, he tells the Quartermaster General to stop ordering supplies and suspends the draft and further recruitment. With these orders, he saves the nation $4 million a day. Though Grant hates public appearances, the city of Washington has planned the Grand Illumination celebration for this very night, specifically so he can be there. The Capitol Dome will be lit, the Willard Hotel will illuminate the word Union, and the governmental buildings are having a competition to see which can be the most brilliantly decorated. Stanton is fussing over the War Department's display, which includes guns and flags as well as lights, while over at the Patent Office, some 5,000 candles will glow from every window. There will also be a massive fireworks display, and of course the bonfires that have blazed all week will still be burning bright. As intensely as Washington celebrated on Monday, Thursday night's grand illumination will be even more monumental. That afternoon, Grant meets with Lincoln in the Oval Office. The last time they met was the day after Petersburg fell, on that veranda in the midst of that shattered city. There, Grant promised Lincoln that he would catch Lee and end the war. Now that Grant has fulfilled that promise, a grateful Lincoln offers his congratulations. He calls for a carriage. The two men ride around the crowded streets of Washington with the top down, shocking the flood of arriving visitors who can't believe that they are actually laying eyes on President Lincoln and General Grant. The ride is Lincoln's way of giving Grant his moment in the sun after so many months of being second-guessed and labeled a butcher and of deflecting the glory showered upon him onto the man whose genius made it all possible. It works. The two men are loudly cheered on every street corner. When it is done, they make plans to meet again that night for the illumination. They will be the center of attention, these two men who won the Civil War, watched by one and all. Meantime, John Wilkes Booth and his band of assassins tend to their work of sharpening knives and cleaning their pistols, eager for their night of reckoning. Chapter 25, Thursday, April 13th, 1865, Washington, nighttime. The four conspirators squeeze into room 6 at the Herndon House Hotel a few blocks from the White House. Booth, David Harold, Lewis Powell, and George Ezerode lounge on the chairs and perch on the edge of the bed as Booth talks them through the plan. His recruiting trip to Baltimore was unsuccessful. He is too agitated to sit, so he paces as he thinks out loud. The wooden floor becomes a stage, and his oration a performance that takes him from stage left to stage right, then back to stage left again as he breaks down the plan. The parties outside are neither a distraction nor an offense, but a reminder of why they have gathered. Logically, each man knows that there must be plenty of Confederate sympathizers in Washington, huddled in their homes with jaws clenched as they endure the revelry. But right now, the would-be assassins feel that they are the only ones who can right the grievous wrong. Lewis Powell is the youngest and most experienced of the conspirators. He is a tall, powerfully built, and otherwise very handsome man, save for his face being deformed on one side, thanks to a mule's kick. Unlike the others, Powell has actually killed a man. and may have enjoyed it very much. During the war, the Floridian fought in several major battles, was wounded at Gettysburg, successfully escaped from a prisoner of war camp, and worked for the Confederate Secret Service. He is a solid horseman and quick with a knife. Thanks to his military training, Powell knows the value of reconnaissance. He prepped for his attack that morning by walking past Secretary of State Seward's home on Madison Place, scoping out the best possible ways in and out of the building. He boldly struck up a conversation with Seward's male nurse just to make sure the secretary was indeed at home. The reconnaissance is good news for Booth. He thus knows the locations of two of the intended victims. Now it is his job to find Lincoln. An afternoon talking to stage managers had led to the inescapable conclusion that Lincoln is not going to the theater tonight. Booth, it seems, will not have his grand theatrical moment. Much to his dismay, it appears as if shooting Lincoln will be as mundane as putting a bullet into his brain on a crowded street during the grand illumination and then running like hell. It finally dawns on one very drunk George Azaro that the plan has shifted from kidnapping to murder. The only reason he joined the conspiracy was that in addition to running a small carriage repair business in Port Tobacco, Maryland, he moonlights as a smuggler, ferrying mail, contraband, and people across the broad Potomac into Virginia. It is a hard, scrabble, and often dangerous existence. Azarode's role in the kidnapping was to be an act of commerce, not rebellion. He was to be paid handsomely to smuggle the bound and gagged Lincoln into the hands of the Confederates. But there is no longer a Confederacy, no longer a kidnapping plot, no longer a need for a boat, and certainly no longer a need for a smuggler, at least in Azarode's mind. The 30-year-old German immigrant slurs that he wants out. Booth calmly springs his blackmail. Booth cannot do without Azarode. His boat and his knowledge of the Potomac's currents are vital to their escape. A massive manhunt will surely begin the instant Lincoln is killed. Federal officials will seal off Washington and canvass the Maryland and Virginia countryside, but with Azarode's guidance, Booth and his men will rush through rural Maryland ahead of the search parties, cross the Potomac, and then follow smugglers' routes south to Mexico. Booth has rehearsed for this moment. He knows his lines and recites them with great drama. "Then we will do it," Booth says, nodding at Harold and Powell, never taking his eyes off the drunk German. "But what will become of you?" And then, as if pulling the solution out of thin air, "You had better come along and get your horse." At the word horse, Azarode's heart skips a beat. He's trapped. Booth long ago suggested that the two men share horses from time to time. The horse a man rides is part of his identity. By sharing Booth's favorite horse, which seemed like such a simple and thoughtful gesture on the actor's part all those weeks ago, Azarode is now visibly connected to the assassination plot. Azarode has ridden Booth's horse all over Washington and has even helped him sell a few animals, so there will be no shortage of witnesses. Azarode sighs and nods his head. Murder it is. There is no way out for him. The time has come. The four men stand, aware that they are about to commit the greatest crime in the history of the United States. Before opening the door, Booth reminds them that their post-assassination rendezvous point is the road to Nanjemoy on the Maryland side of the Potomac. Normally, the sight of a lone horseman galloping out of Washington long after dark would make the sentries guarding the bridges suspicious. But tonight is not a normal night. All those folks who come into Washington for the illumination will be making their way back home when it's all done. Booth and his men will easily blend in with the same drunken, bleeding masses who are now making that wretched noise on the streets outside Room 6. If for some reason they can't do the job tonight, they will remain in Washington and try again tomorrow. Booth shakes hands with each man. They leave one at a time to go their separate ways. Chapter 26, Thursday, April 13th, 1865, Washington, nighttime. There once was a fifth conspirator, the one Booth traveled to Baltimore to corral the day before, Mike O'Loughlin. A former Confederate soldier who grew up across the street from Booth was one of the first men recruited by him last August. Just a month earlier, the two men had lain in wait together for a certain carriage making its way down the lonely country road to Soldier's Home. only to find that its occupant was a Supreme Court justice instead of the president. Hiding in the tall grass alongside of the road, Olathun had weighed the repercussions of actually kidnapping the president of the United States and realized that he would hang by the neck until dead if caught. He was actually relieved that the carriage belonged to Salmon Chase instead of Abraham Lincoln. The 24-year-old engraver returned to Baltimore and put the kidnapping plot behind him. He wanted a normal life. When Booth came calling a week later with an even more far-fetched plot to kidnap the president by handcuffing him at the theater and then lowering his body to the stage, O'Loughlin shook his head and told Booth to go away. But Booth is nothing if not relentless. In Baltimore, he tried to convince O'Loughlin to rejoin the conspiracy. O'Loughlin told the actor he didn't want any part of the killing. Yet the same day, he apparently changed his mind and traveled to Washington a short time later. O'Loughlin started drinking the minute he arrived, bellying up to the bar at a place called Roman's until his behavior became erratic. Like Booth, who now prowls Washington in the desperate hope of finding Lincoln, O'Loughlin prowls the bustling thoroughfares, unsure of what to do next. Meantime, General Sam Grant, whose idea of a stellar evening is chain-smoking cigars and sipping whiskey, would be very happy staying in for the evening. But as Julia points out, General and Mrs. Grant have not attended a party together for quite some time. Sitting in their room on this very special night, no matter how luxurious the accommodations, would be a waste. Julia shows her husband invitation after invitation to party after party. She's thrilled to be in the city, but also eager to leave as soon as possible to rejoin their four children. Knowing that they have perhaps just this one night in Washington, Grant agrees that they should venture out. Reluctantly, Grant leaves the hotel. They engage a carriage to take them to the home of Secretary of War Stanton, who's holding a gala celebration for War Department employees. Four brass bands serenade the partygoers from nearby Franklin Square, and a fireworks demonstration will cap the night. Grant has been a target ever since he took command of Lincoln's army, but even with all the people in the streets, he is unafraid. The war is over. The Grants arrive at Stanton's home. A bodyguard stands at the top of the steps, one of the few the general has encountered in Washington. The Grants are greeted with a loud round of applause as they join the partygoers, but they are soon lost in the sea of other prominent faces. Grant gets a drink and settles in to endure the politicking and glad-handing soon to head his way. But the Grants have been followed. Michael Laughlin, wearing a dark suit, marches up the front steps of Stanton's house and tries to crash the party. The sergeant providing security brushes him off, telling the unwanted guest, if you wish to see him, step out on the pavement or the stone where the carriage stops. O'Loughlin disappears into the night, only to return later, asking to see Secretary Stanton. Coincidentally, Stanton and Grant are both standing just a few feet away, watching the fireworks. There is still something of the conspirator in O'Loughlin, a willingness to take risks where others might not. He takes a bold gamble, blends in with the crowd, and slips undetected into the party, despite the security detail. He then goes one better by walking over and standing directly behind Stanton. But Mike O'Loughlin does nothing to harm the Secretary of War, nor does he bother Grant. The fact is, he doesn't know what Stanton looks like. And as a former Confederate soldier with a deep respect for rank, he is too nervous to speak with Grant. Observers will later remember the drunk in the dark coat and suggest that his intentions were to kill the general and the secretary. Nothing could be further from the truth. The surprising fact is that O'Loughlin is actually here to warn them about Booth. But even after all those drinks, Michael O'Loughlin still cannot summon the courage. He thinks of the repercussions and how, if he informs on Booth, his childhood friend will most surely reveal the story about the kidnapping attempt 4 weeks earlier. That admission would mean the same jail sentence or even execution for O'Loughlin as for Booth. No, nothing good can come of telling Stanton or Grant a single detail of the plot. Michael O'Loughlin disappears into the night and drinks himself blind. Meantime, a crowd gathers in front of Stanton's home. For all his attempts at avoiding the limelight, word of Grant's location has spread throughout the city. Cries of speech rock the night air. His admirers thoroughly unaware that Grant is terrified of public speaking. Stanton comes to the rescue. Never afraid of expressing himself, the secretary throws out a few bon mots to pacify his audience. Grant says nothing, but the combination of a small wave to the crowd and Stanton's spontaneous words are enough to satiate Grant's fans. Soon the sidewalks are bare. On the other side of town, John Wilkes Booth steps back into the National Hotel, frustrated and tired from hours of walking bar to bar, party to party, searching for Lincoln. The Derringer rests all too heavily in his coat pocket, in its barrel the single unfired round that could change the course of history. There has been no news of any other assassinations, so we can only assume that his conspirators have also failed. And he's right. Harold, Azarode, and Powell were all unable to conquer their fears long enough to cross the line from fanatic to assassin. Perhaps tomorrow. 1 mile away, in his White House bedroom, Abraham Lincoln slumbers peacefully. A migraine has kept him in for the night. Hopefully that will not be the case tomorrow evening, for the Lincolns have plans to attend the theater. Part 3, The Long Good Friday. Chapter 27, Friday, April 14th, 1865, Washington, 7 a.m. It is Good Friday morning, the day on which Jesus Christ was crucified, died an agonizing death, and was quickly buried. All of this after he had been betrayed by Judas and scorned by a public that had lionized him just days before. Abraham Lincoln is a religious man, but not a churchgoer. He was born into a Christian home in the wilderness, where established churches were rare. His father and mother were staunch hard-shell Baptists, and at a young age he attended the Pigeon Creek Baptist Church. Lincoln's church attendance became sporadic in his adult life. Nevertheless, he took comfort in reading the Bible on a daily basis and often used the words of God to make important points in his public pronouncements. Indeed, his faith has grown because of the war. But because Lincoln never attached himself to an organized religion as an adult, his ability to combine the secular and the religious in the way he goes about his life will later have everyone from atheists to humanists to Calvinists claiming that he is one of theirs. The truth is, Abraham Lincoln does believe in God and has relied on Scripture in overcoming all the challenges he has confronted. Lincoln rises at 7 a.m. Outside the White House, the Washington weather is a splendid, sunny 50 degrees. Dogwoods are blooming along the Potomac, and the scent of spring lilacs carries on the morning breeze as the president throws his size 14 feet over the edge of the bed, slides them into a pair of battered slippers, pulls on an equally weathered robe, pushes open the rosewood bedroom door, says good morning to his night watchman, and walks down a second-floor hallway to the White House library. The quiet night at home has been good for his soul. Lincoln's sleep was restful. All the symptoms of his migraine have disappeared. Petitioners sleeping in the White House hallway leap to their feet upon the sight of Lincoln. They have come seeking presidential favors, a pardon, a job, an appointment. The president is courteous but evasive at their shouted requests, eager to be alone in the quiet of the library. That strangers actually sleep on the White House floor is commonplace at the time. The multitude, washed or unwashed, always has free egress and ingress into the White House, an astonished visitor wrote earlier in Lincoln's presidency. The White House's open-door policy ends today. The president's favorite chair is in the exact center of the room. He sits down and opens his Bible, not because it is Good Friday, but because starting the day with Scripture is a lifelong custom. Glasses balanced on the edge of his prominent nose, he reads a verse, then another, before setting the good book.